Chapter 5. The Dichotomy of Control. On Becoming Invincible. Our most important choice in life, according to Epictetus, is whether to concern ourselves with things external to us or things internal. Most people choose the former, because they think harms and benefits come from outside themselves. According to Epictetus, though, a philosopher, by which he means someone who has an understanding of Stoic philosophy, will do just the opposite. He will look for all benefit and harm to come from himself. In particular, he will give up the rewards the external world has to offer in order to gain tranquility, freedom, and calm. In offering this advice, Epictetus is turning the normal logic of desire fulfillment on its head. If you ask most people how to gain contentment, they will tell you that you must work to get it. You must devise strategies by which to fulfill your desires and then implement those strategies. But, as Epictetus points out, it is impossible that happiness and yearning for what is not present should ever be united. A better strategy for getting what you want, he says, is to make it your goal to want only those things that are easy to obtain, and, ideally, to want only those things that you can be certain of obtaining. While most people seek to gain contentment by changing the world around them, Epictetus advises us to gain contentment by changing ourselves, more precisely, by changing our desires. And he is not alone in giving this advice. Indeed, it is the advice offered by virtually every philosopher and religious thinker who has reflected on human desire and the causes of human dissatisfaction. They agree that if what you seek is contentment, it is better and easier to change yourself and what you want than it is to change the world around you. Your primary desire, says Epictetus, should be your desire not to be frustrated by forming desires you won't be able to fulfill. Your other desires should conform to this desire, and if they don't, you should do your best to extinguish them. If you succeed in doing this, you will no longer experience anxiety about whether or not you will get what you want, nor will you experience disappointment on not getting what you want. Indeed, says Epictetus, you will become invincible. If you refuse to enter contests that you are capable of losing, you will never lose a contest. Epictetus's handbook opens, somewhat famously, with the following assertion: some things are up to us, and some are not up to us. He offers our opinions, impulses, desires, and aversions as examples of things that are up to us, and our possessions and reputation as examples of things that aren't. From this assertion, it follows that we are faced with a choice in the desires we form. We can want things that are up to us, or we can want things that are not up to us. If we want things that are not up to us, though, we will sometimes fail to get what we want, and when this happens, we will meet misfortune and feel thwarted, miserable, and upset. In particular, Epictetus says, it is foolish for us to want friends and relatives to live forever, since these are things that aren't up to us. Suppose we get lucky, and after wanting something that is not up to us, we succeed in getting it. In this case, we will not end up feeling thwarted, miserable, and upset, but during the time we wanted the thing that is not up to us, we probably experienced a degree of anxiety. Since the thing is not up to us, there was a chance that we wouldn't get it, and this probably worried us. Thus, wanting things that are not up to us will disrupt our tranquility, even if we end up getting them. In conclusion, whenever we desire something that is not up to us, our tranquility will likely be disturbed. If we don't get what we want, we will be upset, and if we do get what we want, we will experience anxiety in the process of getting it. Consider again Epictetus's dichotomy of control. He says that some things are up to us and some things aren't up to us. The problem with this statement of the dichotomy is that the phrase, some things aren't up to us, is ambiguous. It can be understood to mean either, there are things over which we have no control at all, or to mean, there are things over which we don't have complete control. If we understand it in the first way, we can restate Epictetus's dichotomy as follows. There are things over which we have complete control, and things over which we have no control at all. But stated in this way, the dichotomy is a false dichotomy, since it ignores the existence of things over which we have some, but not complete control. Consider, for example, my winning a tennis match. This is not something over which I have complete control. No matter how much I practice and how hard I try, I might nevertheless lose a match. Nor is it something over which I have no control at all. Practicing a lot and trying hard may not guarantee that I will win, but they will certainly affect my chances of winning. My winning at tennis is therefore an example of something over which I have some control, but not complete control. This suggests that we should understand the phrase, some things aren't up to us, in the second way. We should take it to mean that there are things over which we don't have complete control. If we accept this interpretation, we will want to restate Epictetus's dichotomy of control as follows. There are things over which we have complete control, and things over which we don't have complete control. Stated in this way, the dichotomy is a genuine dichotomy. Let us therefore assume that this is what Epictetus meant in saying that some things are up to us and some things are not up to us. Now, let us turn our attention to the second branch of this dichotomy, to things over which we don't have complete control. There are two ways we can fail to have complete control over something. We might have no control at all over it, or we might have some, but not complete control. This means that we can divide the category of things over which we don't have complete control into two subcategories. Things over which we have no control at all, such as whether the sun will rise tomorrow, and things over which we have some, but not complete control, such as whether we win at tennis. This, in turn, suggests the possibility of restating Epictetus's dichotomy of control as a trichotomy. There are things over which we have complete control, things over which we have no control at all, and things over which we have some, but not complete control. Each of the things we encounter in life will fall into one and only one of these three categories. Turning the dichotomy of control into a trichotomy. The dichotomy of control. Things over which we have complete control, such as the goals we set for ourselves. The trichotomy of control. Things over which we have complete control, such as the goals we set for ourselves. The dichotomy of control. Things over which we don't have complete control, such as whether the sun rises tomorrow and whether we win while playing tennis. The trichotomy of control. Things over which we have no control at all, such as whether the sun rises tomorrow. Things over which we have some, but not complete control, such as whether we win while playing tennis. In his statement of the dichotomy of control, Epictetus suggests, quite sensibly, that we are behaving foolishly if we spend time worrying about things that are not up to us. Because they are not up to us, worrying about them is futile. We should instead concern ourselves with things that are up to us, since we can take steps either to bring them about or prevent them from happening. On restating the dichotomy of control as a trichotomy, though, we must restate his advice regarding what is and isn't sensible to worry about. To begin with, it makes sense for us to spend time and energy concerning ourselves with things over which we have complete control. In these cases, our efforts will have guaranteed results. Notice, too, that because of the degree of control we have over these things, it will generally require relatively little time and energy for us to make sure they come about. We would be foolish not to concern ourselves with them. What are the things over which we have complete control? In the passage quoted above, Epictetus says we have complete control over our opinions, impulses, desires, and aversions. I agree with Epictetus that we have complete control over our opinions, as long as we properly construe the meaning of opinion. More on this in a moment. I have qualms, though, about including our impulses, desires, and aversions in the category of things over which we have complete control. I would instead place them into the category of things over which we have some, but not complete control, or, in some cases, into the category of things over which we have no control at all. Allow me to explain why. Suppose I am walking through a casino and, on passing a roulette table, detect within me an impulse to place a bet that the number 17 will come up on the next spin of the wheel. I have a degree of control over whether I act on this impulse, but no control over whether it arises in me. If something is truly an impulse, we can't preclude experiencing it. The same can be said of many, but not all, of my desires. When I am on a diet, for example, I might suddenly find myself craving a bowl of ice cream. I have a degree of control over whether I act on this craving, but no control over whether this craving spontaneously arises within me. Likewise, I can't help it that I detect within myself an aversion to spiders. I might, through an act of sheer willpower, pick up and handle a tarantula, despite this aversion, but I can't help it that I don't like spiders. These examples suggest that Epictetus is wrong to include our impulses, desires, and aversions into the category of things over which we have complete control. They belong instead in the category of things over which we have some, but not complete control, or, in some instances, in the category of things over which we have no control at all. But having said this, I should add that it is possible that something important has been lost in translation, that, in speaking of impulses, desires, and aversions, Epictetus had in mind something different than we do. What then are the things over which we have complete control? To begin with, I think we have complete control over the goals we set for ourselves. I have complete control, for example, over whether my goal is to become the next pope, a millionaire, or a monk in a Trappist monastery. Having said this, I should add that although I have complete control over which of these goals I set for myself, I obviously don't have complete control over whether I achieve any of them. My achieving the goals I set for myself instead typically falls into the category of things over which I have some, but not complete control. Another thing I think we have complete control over is our values. We have complete control, for example, over whether we value fame and fortune, pleasure, or tranquility. Whether or not we live in accordance with our values is, of course, a different question. It is something over which we have some, but not complete control. Epictetus, as we have seen, thinks we have complete control over our opinions. If by opinions he has in mind our opinions on what goals we should set for ourselves, or our opinions on the value of things, then I agree with him that our opinions are up to us. It will clearly make sense for us to spend time and energy setting goals for ourselves and determining our values. Doing this will take relatively little time and energy. Furthermore, the reward for choosing our goals and values properly can be enormous. Indeed, Marcus thinks the key to having a good life is to value things that are genuinely valuable and be indifferent to things that lack value. He adds that because we have it in our power to assign value to things, we have it in our power to live a good life. More generally, Marcus thinks that by forming opinions properly, by assigning things their correct value, we can avoid much suffering, grief, and anxiety, and can thereby achieve the tranquility the Stoics seek. Besides having complete control over our goals and values, Marcus points out that we have complete control over our character. We are, he says, the only ones who can stop ourselves from attaining goodness and integrity. We have it entirely within our power, for example, to prevent viciousness and cupidity from finding a home in our soul. If we are slow-witted, it might not be in our power to become a scholar, but there is nothing to stop us from cultivating a number of other qualities, including sincerity, dignity, industriousness, and sobriety. Nor is there anything to stop us from taking steps to curb our arrogance, to rise above pleasures and pains, to stop lusting after popularity, and to control our temper. Furthermore, we have it in our power to stop grumbling, to be considerate and frank, to be temperate in manner and speech, and to carry ourselves with authority. These qualities, Marcus observes, can be ours at this very moment, if we choose for them to be. Now let us turn our attention back to the second branch of the trichotomy of control, to things over which we have no control at all, such as whether the sun will rise tomorrow. It is obviously foolish for us to spend time and energy concerning ourselves with such things. Because we have no control at all over the things in question, any time and energy we spend will have no effect on the outcome of events, and will therefore be wasted time and energy. And, as Marcus observes, Nothing is worth doing pointlessly. This brings us to the third branch of the trichotomy of control, those things over which we have some but not complete control. Consider, for example, winning a tennis match. As we have seen, although we can't be certain of winning a match, we can hope, through our actions, to affect the outcome. We therefore have some, but not complete control. Given that this is so, will a practicing Stoic wish to concern himself with tennis? In particular, should he spend time and energy trying to win matches? We might think he shouldn't, because the Stoic doesn't have complete control over the outcome of a tennis match. There is always a chance that he will lose. But if he loses, he will likely be upset, and his tranquility will be disturbed. A safer course of action for a Stoic, then, would seem to be to refrain from playing tennis. By similar reasoning, if he values his tranquility, it seems as though he should not want his wife to love him. There is a chance that, regardless of what he does, she won't, and he will be heartbroken. Likewise, he shouldn't want his boss to give him a raise. There is, again, a chance that, regardless of what he does, she won't, and he will be disappointed. Indeed, taking this line of thought a step further, the Stoic shouldn't even have asked his wife to marry him, or his boss to hire him, since they might have turned him down. One might conclude, in other words, that Stoics will refuse to concern themselves with things over which they have some, but not complete control. But because most of the things that come up in daily living are things over which we have some but not complete control, it would follow that Stoics will not concern themselves with many aspects of everyday life. They will instead be passive, withdrawn underachievers. Indeed, they will resemble depressed individuals who might not even be able to rouse themselves from bed in the morning. Before we succumb to this line of argument, though, we should recall that the Stoics weren't passive and withdrawn. To the contrary, they were fully engaged in daily life. From this, one of two conclusions follows. Either the Stoics were hypocrites who did not act in accordance with their principles, or we have, in the above argument, somehow misinterpreted Stoic principles. I shall now argue for this second alternative. Remember that among the things over which we have complete control are the goals we set for ourselves. I think that when a Stoic concerns himself with things over which he has some but not complete control, such as winning a tennis match, he will be very careful about the goals he sets for himself. In particular, he will be careful to set internal rather than external goals. Thus, his goal in playing tennis will not be to win a match, something external over which he has only partial control, but to play to the best of his ability in the match, something internal, over which he has complete control. By choosing this goal, he will spare himself frustration or disappointment should he lose the match. Since it was not his goal to win the match, he will not have failed to attain his goal, as long as he played his best. His tranquility will not be disrupted. It is worth noting at this point that playing to the best of your ability in a tennis match and winning that match are causally connected. In particular, what better way is there to win a tennis match than by playing to the best of your ability? The Stoics realized that our internal goals will affect our external performance, but they also realized that the goals we consciously set for ourselves can have a dramatic impact on our subsequent emotional state. In particular, if we consciously set winning a tennis match as our goal, we arguably don't increase our chances of winning that match. In fact, we might even hurt our chances. If it starts looking, early on, as though we are going to lose the match, we might become flustered, and this might negatively affect our playing in the remainder of the game, thereby hurting our chances of winning. Furthermore, by having winning the match as our goal, we dramatically increase our chances of being upset by the outcome of the match. If, on the other hand, we set playing our best in a match as our goal, we arguably don't lessen our chances of winning the match, but we do lessen our chances of being upset by the outcome of the match. Thus, internalizing our goals with respect to tennis would appear to be a no-brainer. To set as our goal playing to the best of our ability has an upside, reduced emotional anguish in the future, with little or no downside. When it comes to other, more significant aspects of his life, a Stoic will likewise be careful in the goals he sets for himself. Stoics would recommend, for example, that I concern myself with whether my wife loves me, even though this is something over which I have some, but not complete, control. But when I do concern myself with this, my goal should not be the external goal of making her love me. No matter how hard I try, I could fail to achieve this goal, and would, as a result, be quite upset. Instead, my goal should be an internal goal, to behave, to the best of my ability, in a lovable manner. Similarly, my goal with respect to my boss should be to do my job to the best of my ability. These are goals I can achieve, no matter how my wife and my boss subsequently react to my efforts. By internalizing his goals in daily life, the Stoic is able to preserve his tranquility while dealing with things over which he has only partial control. The trichotomy of control. Categories of things. Things over which we have complete control. Example, the goals we set for ourselves, the values we form. Epictetus's advice, we should concern ourselves with these things. Categories of things. Things over which we have no control at all. Example, whether the sun will rise tomorrow. Epictetus's advice, we should not concern ourselves with these things. Categories of things, things over which we have some, but not complete control. Example, whether we win while playing tennis. Epictetus's advice, we should concern ourselves with these things, but we should be careful to internalize the goals we form with respect to them. It is especially important, I think, for us to internalize our goals if we are in a profession in which external failure is commonplace. Think, for example, about an aspiring novelist. To succeed in her chosen profession, she must fight and win two battles. She must master her craft, and she must deal with rejection of her work. Most novelists hear no many, many times before hearing yes. Of these two battles, the second is, for most people, the hardest. How many would-be novelists, one wonders, don't submit the manuscript they have written because they dread hearing the word no? And how many would-be novelists, on hearing no once, are crushed by the experience and never resubmit the manuscript? How can the aspiring novelist reduce the psychological cost of rejection and thereby increase her chances of success? By internalizing her goals with respect to novel writing. She should have as her goal not something external over which she has little control, such as getting her novel published, but something internal over which she has considerable control, such as how hard she works on the manuscript, or how many times she submits it in a given period of time. I don't claim that by internalizing her goals in this manner, she can eliminate altogether the sting when she gets a rejection letter, or, as often happens when she fails to get any response at all to the work she has submitted. It can, however, substantially reduce this sting. Instead of moping for a year before resubmitting her manuscript, she might get her moping period down to a week, or even a day, and this change will dramatically increase her chance of getting the manuscript published. Readers might complain that the process of internalizing our goals is really little more than a mind game. The would-be novelist's real goal is obviously to get her novel published, something she knows full well, and in advising her to internalize her goals with respect to the novel, I am doing little more than advising her to pretend as if getting published weren't her goal. In response to this complaint, I would point out, to begin with, that it might be possible for someone, by spending enough time practicing goal internalization, to develop the ability not to look beyond her internalized goals, in which case they would become her real goals. Furthermore, even if the internalization process is a mind game, it is a useful mind game. Fear of failure is a psychological trait, so it is hardly surprising that by altering our psychological attitude toward failure, by carefully choosing our goals, we can affect the degree to which we fear it. The Stoics, as I have explained, were very much interested in human psychology and were not at all averse to using psychological tricks to overcome certain aspects of human psychology, such as the presence in us of negative emotions. Indeed, the negative visualization technique described in the previous chapter is really little more than a psychological trick. By thinking about how things could be worse, we forestall, or reverse, the hedonic adaption process. It is, nevertheless, a singularly effective trick, if our goal is to appreciate what we have rather than taking it for granted, and if our goal is to experience joy rather than becoming jaded with respect to the life we happen to be living and the world we happen to inhabit. Having said all this about the internalization of goals, let me pause here to offer a confession. In my studies of Epictetus and the other Stoics, I found little evidence that they advocate internalizing goals in the manner I have described, which raises questions about whether the Stoics in fact made use of the internalization technique. Nevertheless, I have attributed the technique to them, inasmuch as internalizing one's goals is the obvious thing to do if one wishes, as the Stoics did, to concern oneself only with those things over which one has control, and if one wishes to retain one's tranquility while undertaking endeavors that might fail, in the external sense of the word. In talking about the internalization of goals, then, I might be guilty of tampering with or improving on Stoicism. As I shall explain in Chapter 20, I have no qualms about doing this. Now that we understand the technique of internalizing our goals, we are in a position to explain what would otherwise seem like paradoxical behavior on the part of Stoics. Although they value tranquility, they feel duty-bound to be active participants in the society in which they live. But such participation clearly puts their tranquility in jeopardy. One suspects, for example, that Cato would have enjoyed a far more tranquil life if he did not feel compelled to fight the rise to power of Julius Caesar, if he instead had spent his days, say, in a library, reading the Stoics. I would like to suggest, though, that Cato and the other Stoics found a way to retain their tranquility despite their involvement with the world around them. They internalized their goals. Their goal was not to change the world, but to do their best to bring about certain changes. Even if their efforts proved to be ineffectual, they could nevertheless rest easy, knowing that they had accomplished their goal. They had done what they could do. A practicing Stoic will keep the trichotomy of control firmly in mind as he goes about his daily affairs. He will perform a kind of triage, in which he sorts the elements of his life into three categories: those over which he has complete control, those over which he has no control at all, and those over which he has some but not complete control. The things in the second category, those over which he has no control at all, he will set aside as not worth worrying about. In doing this, he will spare himself a great deal of needless anxiety. He will instead concern himself with things over which he has complete control, and things over which he has some but not complete control. And when he concerns himself with things in this last category, he will be careful to set internal rather than external goals for himself, and will thereby avoid a considerable amount of frustration and disappointment.